Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I don't know if you've early voted yet. If you haven't, please be vigilant. If you have, let us know if you've seen or heard of anything problematic. Because yesterday after our show, this was making the rounds. This is from Schuyler County, which is west central Illinois, next to Adams County. So like right, just east of Quincy. And the choices for United States Senate, Tammy Duckworth,
right,
Bill Redpath, and Peggy Hubbard as the Republican nominee.
Oh, no, Kathy Salvey won.
Right. Kathy Salvey is the Republican nominee. Peggy Hubbard is the name on the ballot. It's a certified copy, stamped copy of the ballot that was posted by the Salvey campaign. This came to their attention by some, ostensibly from some alert voter in Schuyler County, and good for them. So whether by incompetence or by corruption, this occurred. And by the way, even though Schuyler County is, as you might expect, a downstate and a small county, heavily Republican, the clerk there is a Democrat. I'm not asserting corruption. As I said, it could be just incompetence. It really doesn't matter. You get sort of the same result. And this is Illinois, so be vigilant is my point. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. We normally talk about what are you seeing and hearing on election day, but since we start elections about 7 months, we start voting about 7 months before election day, we need to be vigilant every day that people are allowed to vote.
How in the world could they let that happen? I mean, everybody knows who the Republican candidate is for Senate.
Not everybody, apparently.
But, I mean, there's some connection to her, to Peggy? I just can't believe that they
close. I'm not asserting corruption. I think Peggy Hubbard may have won that county in the primary.
Oh,
but,
okay.
But I am sure that Schuyler County recognizes they're not the only county in the state.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't
then
know.
What do? You just yank all the ballot? I mean, people have already voted.
Well, the problem is you say, well, what's the big deal? If somebody voted for Peggy Hubbard, then that's a vote for Kathy Salvey. It's a vote for the Republican nominee. But right. But the big deal is that's not the choice. The big deal is that the choice is between Duckworth and Salvey. So maybe somebody has a different perspective on Duckworth versus Salvey than they do Duckworth versus Hubbard. Maybe they know Salvey is because they're focused on the general election now and they weren't paying much attention to primary. They didn't know who Peg Hubbard was. So Peg Hubbard, I've never heard of her. I've heard of Duckworth. Kathy Salvey, I've heard of, but she's not on my ballot.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. This way, I never, ever vote early. And I always make sure I'm in town. That's election day is very important to me.
So this is not, this is not so easily remedied, as
right.
People say, to whoever votes for the Republican, they voted for the Republican. The choices, the names actually matter. That's why they're on the ballot.
You can't do a do-over.
No, you can catch it. Hope that it was just a few people. Hope that it was caught early enough that the ballots can be reprinted so that they represent the appropriate nominees on the ballot, and you go from there. I don't know what else you can do when you're talking about a mistake like this. This is why, like I said, vigilance is the order of the day. You know, since we're talking about elections and sort of standards here, I got to go to this John Fetterman interview. John Fetterman is the Democrat socialist nominee for Senate in Pennsylvania, running against Dr. Oz. He's the former lieutenant governor. He's the guy who didn't have a job until his 40s. Mom and dad were paying bills, and he was some mayor of a small town, and then he got elevated, and he, of course, sort of gives off this persona of some, like, WWE tough guy.
Yeah, union hard work and, you know, in the steel mills, none of that. That's what he gives off, but he's not that person.
Correct.
And he recently had a stroke, and he finally sat down with to do a one-on-one with NBC News, and it was a complete disaster.
Well, this is important, this whole matter of capacity for the position. We've had it here. So let's think about it. We had it when Mark Kirk ran for re-election. We had it when John Stroger was basically gone, and he was still on the ballot in for his re-election, Cook County Board President, before son Todd took over. So, I mean, you know, this we've seen it here, so it's an interesting conversation to have about how you factor in a person's physical and mental capacity for the position when it is clearly in question. And, of course, that was part of the discussion in 2020 as it pertains to Joe Biden, and that persists.
And the reporter here said in the small talk before the interview began, it wasn't clear that he was understanding the conversation. So they had to use closed captioning. So there was a computer in front of him. So she would ask the question, and it would print out on the computer, and then he would answer it.
I always thought I was pretty empathetic, emphatic. I think I was very, empathetic. You know, that's an example of the stroke, empathetic. Yeah. I always thought I was very empathetic before having a stroke. But now, after having that stroke, I really understand, you know, much more kind of the challenges that Americans have day in and day out.
Why he's using closed captioning?
That auditory processing where, you know, I'll hear someone speaking, but sometimes I'll be able to be precise on what exactly that they're saying. I use captioning.
And when he debates Dr. Oz later this month, he's going to be using closed captioning, which Dr. Oz agreed to. He said that that was fine.
Well, that doesn't bother me as much. If you have the mental acuity to process what's happening, even if it's not translating to the words that come out of your mouth immediately. Like, I mean, you know, are the synapses firing? You're able to process, you're able to understand, and you're a little slow on the uptake and sort of delivery because of the stroke. I mean, you want to give people wide berth on this, but is that the only issue? And because he's been so dodgy about bringing his doctors forward to explain what happened, what the damage was, where he is in terms of mental capacity, you can understand why people have questions, myself included. And Dasha Burns, this reporter who did the interview for NBC, I mean, she said he had difficulty engaging in small talk.
Yeah.
She said we had set up a monitor so that he could read my questions because he still has lingering auditory processing issues. Now, once he reads the question, he's able to understand. You'll also hear he still has some problems, some challenges with speech. And so she's just describing what happened, and that's not a terrible description. But then she's getting heat, of course, because she's describing what's happening, and it communicates that Fetterman is a bit of an infirm state at minimum, and so it calls into question his capacity for the job.
Yeah. So how is your health, John Fetterman?
Say you're on the road to full recovery, but right now voters really have to take your word for it. We've asked for your medical records. We've asked to have a conversation with someone from your medical team to interview your physician. You've declined those requests. Why?
Well, I feel like we have been very transparent in a lot of different ways. When our doctor has already given a letter saying that I'm able to serve and to be running.
I mean, respectfully, that letter from your physician, that was 6 months ago. Don't voters deserve to know your status now?
Being on in front of thousands and thousands of people and having interviews and getting around all across Pennsylvania, that gives everybody and the voters decide, you know, if they think that it's really the issue.
On crime?
Are you soft on crime?
Of course not. I'm actually effective on crime, and I believe in second chances, and I've run on that record.
Second chances, soft on crime.
Well, I mean, it's you know, I think Alex in Hinsdale is going to voice my position, so I'll defer to him. Alex, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's great to talk with you. The bigger issue with Fetterman, even if he can understand, was his positions for 30 years were to release a third of the prisoners. He has two convicted murderers on his campaign staff, and he'll say, well, they were expunged. They were expunged by him as lieutenant governor. And he's for open-air drug markets. And finally, I'd like to say, this is typical of the anti-worker elitism. Fetterman went to Harvard, has never had a job until he was 50, was bankrolled by his rich parents, was against school choice, but then his parents paid for his two children to go to the most elite private schools in Pennsylvania.
That's right.
It's typical.
Yeah,
and he dresses as call, I mean, I know that's his shtick, but you're running for Senate. Bump up your game a little bit. Take off the gosh darn hoodie and the cargo shorts, and enough is enough. His problem with Dr. Oz is on abortion.
Dr. Oz likes to make fun of me that I might miss a word, but, you know, he's missed, you know, two words, and that is a yes or no on the national abortion ban. If you're going to be our next senator, you have to give the answer.
Yeah, okay, John.
Go back and play your video games in the basement of your mom's house.
Well, I'm sort of in Alex from Hinsdale's camp. I mean, the problem is the policies and frankly his qualifications that have nothing to do with the stroke, which was unfortunate, or his mental acuity. I mean, it sounds like he can process the topics at hand, and the answers he gives are frankly, no worse than the answers you hear from a lot of politicians. So I don't know that he's disqualified based on ability to serve, but I think he is disqualified based on the policy positions he holds. Vince in St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. Yeah, you know, besides him being a creep, okay, my dad had a stroke. Okay, he couldn't do his job, so they let him go. Mm. Okay, but in politics, you could have a stroke and stay in your job. I don't know if that's actually fair. It seems like, yeah, Kirk and Fetterman, they could.
Stroger.
Yeah, it's Stroger. Really important.
Stroger.
Because I know
about
how, like,
John Stroger. Yeah. John Stroger was basically gone.
Yeah,
And they didn't make the. I mean, but you know, look, I mean, Vince, let's be fair. I mean, there's a lot of people. Thanks for the call. In public office, who are walking around who are brain dead. They are dead from the neck up, but they always have been. And it has nothing to do with an ailment. It's just, I don't know. I don't know the parents, yeah. Schools. I don't know what happened to some of these people, but they are like jellyfish. They just have a bulbous head. There is nothing in it. So, there you go.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Yesterday, my PAC launched a billboard campaign. So please, on your commute, I mean, don't take your eyes off the road, but you may notice... You may notice billboards around the Chicagoland area on all the major thoroughfares with the pictures of Pritzker and Lightfoot sharing a nice moment. Pritzker, I've used in a spot before, actually, the Summer of Joy spot. The caption, Chicago's Get Out of Jail Free Cards, the two of them. So take a look for those 42 locations around Chicagoland.
All right, and there, and the behind it is a jail. There's a picture. There's a jail.
Jail bars.
Yeah, jail bars.
Yeah, well,
that's good.
It's just a way to provide a friendly reminder as you navigate around the region, who's responsible for the violence that's been unleashed in the city, and what those two will mean for the suburbs and the rest of the state if they're reelected and their purge law is enacted. And by the way, that's very much in question, not because of anything the General Assembly's doing.
No. Why would they do anything for us?
But because of what more than half of the county state's attorneys have now done, which is filed suit against the state seeking to enjoin the implementation of the purge law, the get out of jail free law. The other day in Decatur, maybe this was brought home to people when those two officers were shot. Amber Dobson Oberheim posted on Facebook about it. Two more officers shot last night on my home turf. Two more officers doing their job, protecting their community. Two more families received that information in the middle of the night. Two more. And thank God those two officers are still with us. When is enough enough, Governor J.B. Pritzker, she asks. At the State Police Memorial in May of this year, you promised me you would step up for my police family. I don't know about you, but when I make a promise, I keep it. What have you done? What is it going to take for you to follow through on your commitment? I expect swift, effective action on your part to put a stop to the nonsense that is happening to my police family on your watch. I like to think you are better than that, but I have also learned that people show you who they are if you allow them to. I've been to Springfield 3 times. I came straight to your office to have a face-to-face conversation with you. I wrote you a letter delivered with over 100 more, which included my personal contact information, but never heard anything in return. Then I had a moment to look you in the eye and make sure you understood my expectation in May. I'm not one to take this kind of conversation to social media, but what choice do I have when my repeated efforts have fallen on deaf ears? I want you to make the right choice and do the right thing. Heck, I want to be your fan, but I simply cannot do that.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Simply cannot do that. And the question is, are you going to let J.B. Pritzker and this political class get away with telling you that this purge law, opposed, I will say again, by 100 of the state's 102 county state's attorneys, most of the sheriffs, innumerable number of police chiefs, they're providing you, you've heard it on this show, details not about the men and women who crafted and passed this law, but about the real-world impacts of this law from practitioners in the space on a daily basis. So are you going to, if you think this is, delude yourself with another acceptable lie that this is really about J.B. Pritzker and Lori Lightfoot and their fellow travelers getting moms who stole diapers and formula for their infants out of jail? That's literally what J.B. Pritzker repeats, and he did again at the debate last week. You're going to be treated. You're going to allow yourself to be treated like that. That's what the formula you're going to buy from this governor. And if you're not, then how do you bring yourself to participate in the continuation of this with these people? It's baffling to me. And it's baffling to an increasing number of Illinoisans, as you're hearing from Amber Dobbs and Oberheim and many others. It's baffling to a number of prosecutors, particularly those in the couple of offices where you have a state's attorney supportive of unleashing lawlessness. So, for example, Kim Fox. Yeah, this has become a national story, not just the law, but also the implications. We heard this, too, that the headline in Fox News, Chicago crime frustrations mount against state's attorney Kim Fox as Max exodus continues. Mm-hmm. More than 235 people have resigned from Fox's office since July of last year. Former Cook County state's attorney Dan Kirk, who knows Fox and personally worked in the same office as her under Anita Alvarez, described the head prosecutor as a great individual and an intelligent lawyer, but I mean, that's an interesting setup for the but. She's a great individual. She's an intelligent lawyer, but her, quote, tenure as an elected district attorney has been an abysmal failure. When somebody describes you as a wonderful person and a talented individual and an abysmal failure, I mean, I don't, you know, it's, I don't know where you go for support.
Well, Dan Kirk spoke to Channel 5, Marian Ahern, last night. Because the problem with the Bridgeview Courthouse, Dan, they should have two ASAs, assistant state's attorneys, for each courtroom. So 20 total. There's days when they only have three for the whole court, for all the different courtrooms. So they're in trouble. And Kim Fox talked by phone to NBC5 to, you know, just describe what's going on with, you know, where is everybody? Where's the coverage?
We have asked for assistance and coverage in Bridgeview and throughout the office. Which is not unprecedented.
Yeah, no, these are unprecedented times. Nobody is mining the store.
You heard from Eric Weiss, the Kendall County State's Attorney, when he was on this show last week. You heard from him say, like, you know, if you force the sort of, I mean, I'm translating what he said, but if you force the sort of culture that exists under Kim Fox in Cook County into state's attorney's offices around the state because they have to operate under the strictures of the Purge Act. That's been a choice by Kim Fox. It would be an imposition on everyone else under this law. If you force them to do that, they're going to leave.
Listen to
you're
this.
Not, you're not going to have somebody like Eric Weiss, who spent 16 years as a state attorney and 26 years as a prosecutor. You're not going to have career prosecutors anymore because you're putting them in a position where they can't do their jobs. This is, by the way, I mean, there are so many parallels to this. This is, by the way, for example, why half the teachers in CPS leave within their first 3 years. Because they go into a system that doesn't allow them to do what they got into teaching to do. So they go do something else because they do have talent and ability. So now you're going to bring that to law enforcement as well. People don't, you can't force people to, you know, do the work to become an attorney and a prosecutor. You can't force them to stay.
No, and they're not. They're leaving. 235. And one that left told NBC5's Marian Ahern, quote, everyone's at their breaking point. If you don't do what's on her agenda, you find yourself in an awful experience. And she needs to resign.
It's just a powder keg waiting to explode, and that's the situation that you have right now in this office.
And that's Dan Kirk, who said, you know, people can't take it anymore.
They can't take it anymore, and they're leaving in droves because they just don't want to work for this state's attorney anymore.
Time for her to resign. She's not going to resign. And another point of contention they have, listen to this. Kim Fox and her executive staff, they don't come into the office. And Fox told Channel 5 that, quote, well, I'm looking forward to routines once COVID calms down. That's what she said last night. Honey, COVID is at a low level right now. You can go back to work, and so can your executive staff.
New York City, which beat us to the punch with bail reform, but we're taking it next level. We told you the early data suggests that, surprise, surprise, there's been a spike in violent crime by people who were awaiting trial on felony charges but were given a pass, turned right back on the street. And we see that happen in Chicago, too. This is about as unsurprising a thing as you can have in terms of, here's what we're going to do. Can you figure out what's going to happen? Sure we can. Killings in New York City subway system skyrocket to highest level in 25 years, even as ridership drops. Of course, right, and sort of a Fox Butterfield. Killings are up, ridership's down. The ridership's down because the killings are up. You know what I mean? Since so far in 22, there have been 7 killings. I mean, maybe that doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a lot. And it's not just murders, of course, like we talk about here. Since Pritzker and Lightfoot took office, there's been something like 2,500 murders in the city of Chicago. There's been over 14,000 shootings. People shot. Is that big? Is that a big deal if somebody gets shot? Would you consider it a big deal if you got shot? I think so. Would you consider it a big deal if you got mugged, if you got carjacked? I think so. So you can't just look at the murder stats. You have to look at all the Class X felonies, all the vile conduct, all the lawlessness. It used to be, I know if I don't go to this neighborhood, I will be safe. But today, you don't have that. That's Professor Maria Haberfield from CUNY's John Jay College of Criminal Justice and a former lieutenant in the Israeli National Police talking about New York. So, again, why do we bring up New York? Why do we bring up these other cities? Because they have similar decarceration, defund the police, prosecutors. They are pursuing a similar approach to no cash bail, to tying the hands of police. And Illinois is taking it one step further
right.
than New York.
And that's why a lot of the Cook County Assistant State's Attorneys are leaving before January 1st. And then listen to this. So Marian Ahern asked her, you know, what's wrong? Well, this is, you got to hear it from Kim Fox about this delusional world she lives in.
We asked for feedback, anonymous feedback. Tell us what you think, what you are hearing, what you feel. And the feedback was very positive. And there were people who were saying, listen, there are some people who are here who aren't aligned with the mission and vision and the values of the office.
The values of the office.
Well, I can understand why anybody offering compliments would want to be anonymous. I can understand that. Interestingly, which is a reversal of how things normally are in Chicago, it's surprising how many people who are critical are going on the record. That's what you should take notice of, because that doesn't happen a lot. Most people are cowards, I'm sorry to say, including in law enforcement. Most people do not want to go on the record. They don't want to risk blowback. Oh, my gosh, my pension, this and my that. And to some extent, I understand it. And to a large extent, I don't, because the fears are irrational. And the demand for people to be courageous is so great. But the reality is, this is not arguable. It's just a fact. Very few people will go on the record, even when they're retired, even when they're outside of essentially the purview of the politicians. They just don't want to put themselves out there. So when you have assistant state's attorneys doing so, that should tell you something. That should tell you how bad it is. Phil and Darian.
Hey, good morning, guys. Amy, this is for you. This last debate, this Taman Bradley, is he your buddy?
I know him, yes. He's yes, I've known him for years.
Yeah. Okay, good guy, or?
I mean, I don't know. I can't tell you publicly where he leans politically. But
I can tell you, but yes, he's a leftist, but who cares? Who cares if he's a good guy? I don't care if he's a jagoff, as long as he does his job professionally. That's the problem. He doesn't.
Yeah. So regarding doing his job, I'm wondering, even in this next debate here, if they'll just ask Pritzker straight out, why do 100 out of 102 state's attorneys oppose to this new Let the Scumbag Thugs Out of Jail Act? Why don't they just ask them plain out?
Thanks for the call, Phil. Well,
they have, and reporters have too. It's their fault. They don't understand.
Yeah, the exchange in the debate, what would you change, was a pretty good one, pretty telling one. There's always the cleanup work to be done. There's some language issue, tenses don't agree. Clarifications so people who are confused understand. Amazing. So every, the 90%, 95, 98% of people who are the practitioners, they don't get it. The conversations telling you the prosecutors are having with judges, they don't understand what they know defense attorneys are going to do to take advantage of this law. Nobody understands this except J.B. Pritzker, Lori Lightfoot, Kim Fox, and Eric Einhardt in Lake County. Those four people understand it. Nobody, and the people in the General Assembly who are their stooges who authored it. Nobody else understands. The people that are charged with enforcing the law and providing for public safety, from police to prosecutor to judge, they don't get it. Trust J.B. Pritzker. Okay. I mean, if you want to buy that rap, that's your right as an American. Justin in Cedar Lake, Indiana.
Yeah, Dan, man, you hit it nail on the head. Police officers, why would any cop risk his life to try and arrest somebody when they know they're going to wind up outside of jail? I live in Indiana, and the outpour of people from Illinois coming here is insane. The problem is they bring all their political BS with them, and it's just, Pritzker's just insane. And not only is he hurting Illinois, he's hurting Indiana.
Thanks for the call, Justin.
Yeah, I'm worried about that.
Northwest
Indiana.
Greg in Rogers Park.
Good morning. Dan and Amy, I appreciate all your hard work. Dan, recently I've been going back watching all your Illinois Rising episodes and tying in with the crime. As they got all these guys out of jail and everything, they're also spending way, way too much money, in my opinion. We are broke. Even if Whitaker says we're fine, we're not. We're going to go back to junk bond status if these guys get elected. And the city's a mess. And I just wish that would be brought up more, because right now I think this state could be totally sunk. And it really bothers me that this idiot governor and this mayor say we're physically fine when it's not. And we are in big trouble. And I need to get out there, too, because that's just as dangerous as the crime stuff, in my opinion.
Thanks for the call,
Kim
Greg.
Fox thinks everything's fine, too. Where the feedback I'm getting is wonderful. Oh, okay.
Just to
liars,
get into our way back machine, when Pritzker proposed the graduated state income tax that was defeated by 400,000 votes.
Mm-hmm. 400,000.
He said after its defeat, this is pre-pandemic, there will be cuts and they will be painful. Mm-hmm. We now sit at a crossroads. It would take a 15% cut across the board to balance the state's budget. Everything is on the table. I will never forget what people did who opposed the graduated tax. He was very upset with you.
Yeah, he lost. Took his toys and had to go home.
But listen to what he was saying then. And then came the pandemic, and then came all the federal funny money off the printing press. And now we hear the story that Illinois is a fiscally stable, a model, really, for the nation. Uh-huh. Well, all that money is going to run through the system, and we're going to be back where we were pre-pandemic, except worse, per his own statements pre-pandemic. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Simon says, what is 21 of 42? That, of course, was Simon Gruber from Die Hard 3.
Well, just Die Hard 3. Boy, that is a deep dig. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You bored, Frank?
That was, I'm always working on stuff. But that, of course, is another reference. We talk about The Purge, but in that movie, remember, they were trying to distract the police from their crime. And, they had that bomb in the school in the movie and all that stuff. And then he had his little riddle, what is 21 of 42? And by the way, do you remember the reference? What was 21 of 42? Or
quickly, Frank, we're up against the clock.
Chester A. Arthur, who started this whole mess with our bureaucracy with the Pendleton Act.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for the call.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The degeneration of higher education continues unabated. The average score on ACTs, which is a racist test anyway, so why should we even talk about it? The average score on ACTs fell to its lowest level in more than three decades.
It's bad.
Test takers from the class of 22 scored an average of 19.8. Oof. The first time the average score dropped below 20 since 91. And that's down from 20.3 a year earlier. Fifth consecutive year of failing test scores. The magnitudes of the declines this year, the magnitude, I should say, of the declines this year, is particularly alarming as we see rapidly growing numbers of seniors leaving high school without meeting the college readiness benchmark in any of the subjects we measure.
Gee, Dan, I wonder why this is.
That's what Janet Goodwin, the executive director of the ACT, said. The seniors, rapidly growing numbers of seniors leaving high school without meeting the college readiness benchmark is any of the subjects we measure. Well, you're not measuring the right subjects, clearly. And that's why the test needs to be scrapped or reconstituted.
Yeah, if during COVID, you couldn't even take the test. I know people that would drive to Indiana or Iowa to take the test. And then some universities were accepting ACT scores. Some were not, saying you can just get in with your grade point average. But that says a lot. And it's because of COVID, and people weren't in front of their teachers. They were doing remote learning, right? I mean, that's what I think attributes to it.
No.
We were locked out of our schools for 338 days.
Uh-huh. The magnitudes of the declines, rapidly growing numbers of seniors leaving high school without meeting the college readiness benchmark in any of the subjects we measure. So everything was hunky-dory until COVID came? No, I don't think so. Fifth consecutive year of declines. That predates COVID. So no, I don't think so. I think what we know to be true is backed up by the data, which is that K through 12 is not interested in the subjects that the ACT measures. You know, like reasoning and reading comp and math. It's interested in political activism and identity politics, right? Maybe that has something to do with it. A related story, China's universities rise in world rankings as American schools continue to falter. I mean, America still has a significant presence that dominates really the top 10. But, you know, how they measure these things, here's the bottom line. The editor of these world university rankings saying America can no longer take for granted its decades-long dominance of world higher education and research. It's China that is leading the challenge. If current trends remain, we would see China overtaking the U.S. in the coming years. Well, that may be in part based on the way these things are ranked, looking at the world's top research universities. And it may be in part based on China, however distasteful and despicable that regime is, demanding that their scientists do science and not do politics. I mean, they fall in line with the political, the communism, the communist, the political, the dominant political institution in China that controls all. But they're interested in scientific results. They're not interested in playing equity games with scientists like we are at our universities. Maybe that has something to do with it as well. Gosh, if only there was some evidence of all this. Yeah. University of Illinois paid Ibram Kendi, a.k.a. Henry Rogers,
oh my gosh,
$35,000 for a 60-minute Q&A session.
How much?
Just last week. Yeah. Conversation with Dr. Oh, yeah. Ibram Kendi, hosted by the University of Illinois. I'd love to be a legislator when they come with their tin cup begging for more state funding in the next session and explain the sort of money they spend on all these DAI administrators and all this programming, like 35 grand for Ibram Kendi for 60 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I mean, U of I is hardly alone in bringing these race hustlers to campus and conferring legitimacy to them, because it's not like when you can squeeze in, say, a conservative speaker, the university doesn't stand behind this. They sort of say, even though we all disagree with this fascist, we're going to let him or her say a few words, that sort of thing. With Ibram Kendi, it's a celebration. With Ibram Kendi, it's, you know, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John coming to campus to talk about race. Uh-huh. By contrast, when Kayleigh McEnany, who is, you know, not exactly some iconoclastic conservative philosopher, she's just a comms person. She was just a comms person for a campaign and for a president. Well, she was is, I guess, scheduled to appear next week at Texas Tech University. Texas Tech
in Lubbock, yeah.
And the effort afoot on campus there is for all the leftists to register for the free event and then not go, so they eat up all the space and nobody can show. Allie Duffy, who's a theater and dance professor at Texas Tech University, oh, goody, a real-life fascist is coming to town. Would be a real shame if we all registered for a free event ticket and then not be able to go. Nice English there, theater and dance professor. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, what happened at New York University? They fired a chemist, Matlin Jones Jr., because his organic chemistry course was too hard.
Yeah, we talked about that at length last week.
But still.
No, that's right. Well, that's right.
Bringing it up again, it's like, who's running the asylum?
Well, right. If a test is too hard, you fire the professor.
Right.
If a test is too hard, you stop using it as any sort of part of an individual's academic record to get into your school.
Well, it's just lowering the standards to what? We have no standards at all?
Ben Sasse, apparently outgoing senator from Nebraska.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
An incoming president of University of Florida, the Gators. Wow. Now we're down in Gainesville. And this is how Ben Sasse and his meet the finalist for the presidency of your school session went with kids.
Ben Sasse is about to go, baby. Oh, oh. Ben Sasse is about to go, baby. Oh, oh. Ben Sasse is about to go, baby. Oh, oh.
The place was packed.
Ben Sasse is about to go.
I think Trump was leading those cheers, actually.
Oh.
I mean, so look, the college kids and Trump have something in common. Anyway, as you could tell from the volume, a lot of kids there to
hundreds
to excoriate Ben Sasse. What's his crime? Being a Republican.
But this should scare people. You want students in medical school to have their standards lowered? You want that to become commonplace? No, I don't. That's what you want. Structural engineers to have it easy? No, because when you cross that bridge might fall down.
Candace in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
Oh, that's funny, Amy. I disagree. I say that you could get better health care from a Bush guy in Africa. I know you could get from American doctors, but that's not why I'm calling. I teach part-time. Here's what I'm seeing, and I've discussed this with my principal and other teachers. I don't think that COVID has harmed them as much as vaccine schedules over the years have really, really, really harmed the kids. A lot of them have real issues with short-term memory and I think the vaccines have caused behavioral issues and things like that, and I think that's what they're most damaged from. I really do.
Yeah, well, they were failing before the vaccine, before the COVID came and the vaccines followed. It was American education. I'm sorry. The lack of institutional memory here is frustrating. American higher education, American education generally, was a rolling catastrophe before COVID and the vaccines. This doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen because of a single, in total, it's exacerbated by those things like locking the kids out of school. Not so much on the intellectual development as the social-emotional development, and that then that impacts their academic performance. It's not like there were great things going on at the school. We got to get them back in the classroom for these great things going on in the classroom. No, the point was, let's be clear about this. The point about being in school was the social-emotional piece. It wasn't the quality of the academic schedule. It wasn't the rigor, the intellectual rigor, because it doesn't exist in most places. What are we talking about? Let's remember what we understood about pre-K through post-secondary in 2019. It's not that long ago. Let's remember, I've been talking about it for, decades, but yeah. I mean, it was only a decade ago. USA Today did a look at the 50 public school districts in the 50 most populous cities. 40% had graduation rates under 50%. So you know what they did? They cooked their graduation rates just like Chicago did. And this is what that executive director of ACT is talking about. Oh, no, we'll get our numbers up. You pass, you pass, you pass. Can you do the work? No. Pass, 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 gone. Pass, 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 gone. Stop putting all your eggs in COVID's basket. That's not the beginning, middle, and end of the story about pre-K through post-secondary education in this country. It's actually a small part of the story. Marvin in Burlington.
Good morning. Yeah, I can remember when all this sort of nonsense started. You know, I'm that old, back in women wanted to become firemen, for example, in Chicago when it was number two fire department rated in the world. Oh, we have to lower the weight that women can carry. We have to lower the physical requirements so women can be firemen and lower the standards so certain people can become firemen when they pass the written test or policemen and just.
Yeah, Marvin, you're breaking up on us, but we get the point about lowering the standards. Yeah, that's exactly right. You don't set a high standard and demand excellence and help people achieve excellence. Say, oh, well, this is all that they've been able to show they can do, so we'll just lower the standards to meet them to make sure that we have this social experiment work out like we want it, social engineering. Work out with the demographic distribution we desire, right? A good piece by a father and a professor. Bruce Gilley is a professor at Portland State. I'm blessed to be the father of a beautiful young woman who just began university after graduating from St. Mary's Academy, an all-girls Catholic school in Portland, Oregon. We're Episcopalian, and we're grateful to have our daughter educated in a faith community that emphasized God's presence in all places and striving for the good in every endeavor. Having a girls' school in an ultra-liberal Portland is a challenge. Many students come from radical left-wing families with avowedly anti-Catholic views who forced the school to compromise on the ideal of a non-political education. They didn't force the school. No. The school, like so many schools, chose to...
Bend at the knee, yeah.
Like all Catholic schools, St. Mary's was pressured during the past decade to get woke with equity teams, affinity groups, BLM movements, Native American land acknowledgments, transgender affirmations, climate change hysteria, and the rest. I found myself counting the days until my daughter was out. The school president defined St. Mary's mission as preparing girls, quote, to bridge equity gaps, explore careers in STEM, and advocate for change in every element in society. What does this have to do with COVID? Nothing. prepare girls. This is Catholic school where the daughter of a professor. Bridge equity gaps, explore careers in STEM, and advocate for change in every element of society. He writes, every element in society, this appeal for girls to become mindless agitators without any contemplation of the need, direction, and consequences of change should scare the living daylights out of any parent. Yes, your daughter can grow up to be Jane Fonda. Hooray. Now, by the way, I hold Bruce Gilley to account for not speaking up and saying anything until his daughter was out, which he admits he didn't do. Like, and he says, like most, it says, like, essentially, like most judicious parents or most prudent parents. There's nothing prudent about that. That's cowardice that you're redefining as prudence. Going back to what girls are supposed to grow up to do, bridge equity gaps, explore careers in STEM, advocate for change in every element of society. To me, the list looked rather circumscribed, does Professor Gilley write. I turned the letter over and scribbled down a dozen or so roles that were missing. Loving mother, faithful witness of Christ, steward of a free society, corporate executive, patriot, advocate for parental rights, soldier, caregiver, civil servant. In other words, I noted the things girls are discouraged from being by today's liberal mainstream. I worry my daughter will feel like a failure if she doesn't appear in alumni updates for working on intersectional justice in marginalized communities. I worry that a whole generation of girls is being sent screaming into the culture wars by the social anxieties of its parents. Yeah, that's what you should be worried about. And the ACT scores are reflective of that worry. Lucy in Lowell, Indiana.
Hey, Lucy.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yes, I'd like to expand a little bit. What Candace was really talking about to you was the vaccine schedule. This means the MMR, the DPT, the polio. If you look on Children's Earth Health Defense, they have proved, because Congress was supposed to look into this, about the effects of the vaccines.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for the call, Lucy. Stop it. The vaccine schedules, which have now been added to because of COVID, were constant for generations. The academic performance has not been. Solve for X. Chris and Carrie.
Hey, good morning, guys. This is a frequent topic of conversation at our dinner table since my wife is a teacher, and she has her theories, and one of them is that we've become so reliant on technology, and we've sort of kind of bred these kids to have short attention spans. I mean, she sees it in her classrooms. These kids don't have fine motor skills anymore as far as like using scissors or holding a pencil or a pen. They don't know how to, their dexterity is terrible. They don't even know how to play. Another reason she points to is that so much evaluation is done on these teachers, and so the teachers tend to teach to the test that's going to benefit their evaluation.
They're not doing a very good job, are they, based on NAEP scores and ACT scores? But I'm sure we'll still get 100% proficient to excellent from the teachers.
Like they did at
themselves.
CPS, right? Yeah. CPS are 100% efficient.
Everybody in front of a classroom is just killing it. The kids, not so much.
Well, and they've also gotten away from what she calls thematic teaching. So instead of like taking a subject and spending a week on it and making real world connections and pointing out everyday life and how this affects that, it's quickly move on to the next one because we've got to get to that evaluation. We've got to hit all these subjects. So there's less and less time spent on actually learning about each and every subject within their lesson plan.
That's a good point.
It's interesting. It's scary.
That is a good point. That's the critical thinking skills, the dot connecting that you see, 6 million adults in Illinois who can't do that, can't connect dots. So I take your point. Thanks.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Don't miss Freedom Summit Chicago on November 5th. Get your tickets today before they sell out. Go to FreedomSummitChicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Bank of America warning yesterday that the U.S. will start losing 175,000 jobs a month, like next month. During the first quarter, charts published by Bank of America suggest job losses will continue through much of 2023, which is not inconsistent with Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan's prediction of a recession. He doesn't know how severe next year in the next 6 to 9 months, which is not inconsistent with what we know to be true about the stagflationary environment we're in. And oh, by the way, PPI ticked up yesterday. We get CPI, Consumer Price Index, today. One other, Intel is planning on cutting thousands of jobs in the near term as well. Scrap thousands of jobs to cut fixed costs, deal with the slowdown in the computer market, according to Bloomberg. So it's starting to happen. What we suggested was coming in this stagflationary environment in the summer into the early fall. Now it is upon us, as are the continued inflationary pressures for consumers. The food prices that surged in September, propelling the producer price inflation higher. Fresh and dried vegetables up 16% for the month, 40% for the year. Grains are up 10.7% for the month, 30% for the year. Eggs up 16.7% for the month, 97% for the year.
Can't find eggs for under $3, and bread is now, I saw it yesterday, $4.99. For a loaf of bread that used to cost $1.99.
And so forth. I mean, it's, you know, everything. Dairy products are up 18% for the year. Soft drinks, 16%. Fresh fruit, 21%. Turkey, 38%. And we don't see much of a slowdown. And thus, we have two more rate hikes before the end of the calendar year, it would appear. Phil Kirpin joins us now. He's the president of the American Commitment, chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition as well. Phil, the stagflationary environment I'm describing is bad news for America, but it's probably short-term good political news for Republicans running into November 8th.
Yeah, you know, the obviously the most politically sensitive price is the gasoline price, and we've now got some regional divergence. We had a huge run-up in the Great Lakes region, including where you are, and on the West Coast over the last month. But we had a decline in most of the rest of the country. Now that's kind of reversing because the refinery bottlenecks have been addressed in those regions that were really high. But the global oil price is rising again, so that's going to, you know, cut into the gains that you see from the refinery bottlenecks being met. And so, you know, we're going to maybe see a little bit of divergence in terms of the political impact on a regional basis because of that. But, you know, food, everything you mentioned, everyone's getting hammered by that everywhere. A lot of excuses from Democrats. And, of course, it means that in real terms, people are not getting ahead. They've got less money at the end of the month. And in a lot of cases, people are putting it all on the credit card. And so we've got an explosion of consumer debt as well, which I think is going to make people very uneasy politically. So this is a tough environment for the president's, the incumbent president's party. It always is in the first midterm, but especially with what we're dealing with, you know, on the inflation front.
But have you ever seen anything like this before? I mean, maybe in the 70s.
No, I'm not old enough.
You
know, I'm not old enough. I was a baby the last time this happened, so I don't have active memories of it. And, you know, that's a huge portion of the country that have never lived through this before. And by the way, the people who have lived through it before, they don't especially enjoy living through it again either.
Yeah, right.
I'm just waiting for gas lines.
The salad days of the Carter years. Yeah, that's not a phrase you normally hear. The good news, though, for those that are living through it, particularly living through it coming out of college and out into the workforce, no, they don't have to worry about student loan debt like previous generations. The CBO now saying that the write-off of student loans that the president has proposed, the socialization of them, making other people pay for the loans that were taken out by their fellow Americans, $426 billion pushed the federal deficit to $1.5 trillion for fiscal year 2022. But I mean, $426 billion, that is basically not much in Biden spending terms. So he's accurate.
Well, you know, if you've got 100 million in change households, it's, you know, $4,000 in change per household. I wouldn't call that nothing. I mean, it seems like it's a lot of money to me.
No, I mean, for Biden, Biden's spending
for him, it's another nickel in the till.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's another inflation bomb if it's actually allowed to detonate. And, of course, the CBO score on that does not take into account the changes that he wants to income-driven repayment, which are probably another $500 billion, and maybe more when you consider the incentive that it will create for graduate programs to just completely raise the roof on tuition because their students are never going to pay. Taxpayers at the end of the day pay under his plan because it's 5% of disposable income for 20 years, and then the whole loan balance goes away, and there's no limit on how much you can borrow for graduate school. So these university administrators, other than maybe the very high earning programs like law and medicine, and pretty much all the other graduate school programs, they're going to say, you're not going to pay for it, so what do you care? We'll jack the tuition up to some insane number from what it already is, and taxpayers will hold the bag at the end of the day. And so I think that is a low ball estimate, that initial estimate. The good news is that they cannot actually effectuate any loan terminations, any loan cancellation until October 24th at the earliest. The judge in the state lawsuit that was heard yesterday in St. Louis by the six conservative states that sued said that the Biden administration agreed to a stipulation not to do anything before the 24th to give him time to issue his decision. And of course, if we get a favorable decision, if he says it's unconstitutional, it might never happen. And there's some other cases as well, but that's the one I'm really watching closely.
But how can Biden try and do this without approval from Congress?
Yeah, it's interesting. He's trying to twist a 2003 law called the HEROES Act that was passed after 9/11. And the idea behind that act was if you have a terrorist attack or, at a time of war and you want to give first responders, discharge of their student loans so they don't have to deal with it, they don't have to worry about it, then the Secretary of Education should be able to do that, based on the hardship that's created by that emergency. And we've got a president who's saying, here's the word emergency. COVID's an emergency. I'm going to do it for everyone. And I didn't think the judge was very sympathetic to that argument yesterday. So we'll see how it plays out. But that's what they're trying to hang it on. The problem they've got is, even if you think that's plausible on its face, and I don't really think it is, the Supreme Court just said in West Virginia versus EPA that you can't create a new program on a major question out of an old law sitting on a shelf. You need to have clear instruction from Congress to do it. And the Biden administration doesn't even deal with that. They don't even address it in their legal memo. And so I think that's a big problem for them.
Since you're president of the American Commitment, a couple of weeks back, Kevin McCarthy and House Republicans rolled out their commitment to America. You had Rick Scott on the other side of the other chamber, the Senate, roll out his plan for the Republican Party, his vision for Senate Republicans several months earlier over the summer. I understand that elections are referenda on incumbents, and they should be, and the party in power, and it should be. But what is your assessment of what House and Senate Republicans have offered in terms of a competing vision?
Well, I think it's fine as far as it goes. I think it's intentionally somewhat vague because, as you point out, they want it to be about the failures of the incumbent party more than what they would do differently with some level of detail. So, as always, the test is what they actually do when they're back in power. Remember, this is the party that spent 10 years telling us they were going to repeal Obamacare. Then they got the House, Senate, and White House, and McCain came out with his thumbs down, and they basically did nothing on health care and ceded the issue back to the Democrats. And so, I think they've got the right themes in there. They say they're going to tackle inflation. They're going to tackle crime. They've got kind of the list of hot buttons that people care about. But the real test is going to be whether they actually can deliver on any of that, and in particular, whether they can get federal spending under control. Because as long as the federal government keeps massively spending, the Federal Reserve is going to be buying most of those bonds, and that means they're going to be printing money, and we're going to continue to have a very high inflation environment no matter what else is going on. And so they're saying the right things. The real test will be what they do if they get handed power back.
Well, right. It's just it's telling, I think, because I know that if Republicans take the Senate, I know Ron Johnson and Rand Paul are going to be going after Tony Fauci and CDC and making sure they're held to account. This public health combine is held to account for the choices they made and the way that they pursued them during the pandemic. I know if the Republicans take the Senate, that Chuck Grassley and Ron Johnson here again are going to give the FBI and perhaps the CIA a full proctology exam. But, you know, when it comes to some of the other issues, I find myself having a difficult time pointing to senators or members of the House Republican caucus that I know they're going to do this. I know they're going to do that. I know that this is going to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, I agree that we're going to get some very important oversight on all the COVID stuff if we get a Republican Senate. The interesting question is, will we get that if we get a Republican House but not a Republican Senate? I mean, who's the Rand Paul or Ron Johnson on the House side? Who's in line to chair oversight? James Comer? I mean, I haven't seen one work. You know, that is a potential cause for concern if we get a split outcome, whether they're going to really, you know, do serious oversight even on that issue on the House side. I assume, you know, they can't not do something, so they'll have some hearings. But is there someone who really has that motivation, that desire to dig deep on it and to hold people accountable? You know, I'm not sure. So I certainly hope, you know, that we'll see gavels in the hands of the guys you mentioned, because I do think that they'll do that. But, you know, the people who go into politics are politicians, right? You know, they're not getting elected and reelected first and foremost. And so they're always going to say the things that they're supposed to say to look like they care about the things that people care about. The real test is what they do when they actually get into power. And you never know, because they do tend to let us down a little bit. But you know, I think that's kind of going to be on us to really hold their feet to the fire, but also to make their jobs easy, to hand them the stuff, you know, to write these things up, to do briefing books and so on.
Well, I know, and that's why Ron Johnson in particular, I think, deserves so much credit, because he's taken on issues because they were the right issues to take on, because what was going on was wrong, not because they were necessarily politically popular in his very swing state of Wisconsin. Rand Paul's got a little bit more insulation in Kentucky. Ron Johnson has no insulation, and particularly with the COVIDian governor there, Tony Evers, and he was willing to be outspoken. He was willing to have hearings. He was willing to call in doctors and public health professionals that had been banned by our big tech overlords. And if he wins re-election, and I think he's going to in Wisconsin, despite taking on issues that probably don't poll all that well. Certainly, if you were looking at what issues do I want to talk about, you wouldn't lead with COVID. You wouldn't lead with necessarily FBI oversight and public criticism. But he did it anyway because it's the right thing, which is why for as much as some people had problems with Ron Johnson and whether or not he was, you know, properly allied with Trump all the time, I mean, he deserves a lot of credit for what he did in those two areas.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think, you know, one of the reasons that Wisconsin, of course, you know, wasn't sort of a COVIDian hellhole the way Illinois was, of course, is that their state Supreme Court struck down most of the COVID orders from their governor. And, you know, I don't know if that happens if you don't have, you know, a state Republican Party with people like Ron Johnson that are sort of outspoken and sort of set, you know, stake in the ground. As much as you want to think that cases are decided on the law, you know, sometimes the atmospherics really do make a difference. And so that may have been one of the reasons that they had, you know, the relatively good outcome that they did. But I mean, I think that the COVID issue plays into people's larger concerns about education. We just got the ACT numbers yesterday, and 42% of graduating seniors last year failed all four of the benchmarks for college readiness, by far the all-time record. Our kids are not learning, okay? What they are learning is, you know, political left wokeness stuff, not basic, you know, subject matter that they're supposed to have in schools. And of course, we've got all of the gender craziness, and when we've got, you know, the masks and the closures and all of that. So we have a mix of ingredients
for education to become a Republican issue this election, really for the first time ever. And, you know, that kind of adds to everything else. But, you know, the question, of course, is, you know, what can you actually do on that stuff, which is, you know, primarily local? And it's especially tricky for Republicans at the federal level to figure out, you know, how do you address some of these things without overstepping, without yourself interfering with, you know, state and local purview? And, you know, I think they really need to focus on eliminating the bad federal policies that are driving some of these things more so than trying to, you know, pile on their own, you know, federal intervention.
He is Phil Kirpin, president of the American Commitment, chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition. Phil, thanks as always.
All right. Have a good one.
Thanks. You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This journalist, in quotation marks, really went above and beyond the call. A journalist on the East Coast, David Levitt, self-described award-winning multimedia journalist. You ever notice how many journalists are award-winning in their profile description?
If they won an Emmy.
Oh, yeah.
The coveted Emmy.
Yeah.
Congratulations. You won an Emmy off of someone's pain. Thanks. Oh, I'm so honored. Please, I'll take the awards. Yes.
They just rotate the awards through these regional press corps. It's a joke. Because they're a joke. David Levitt called Child Protective Services on a Republican Virginia State Senate candidate and single mom, Tina Ramirez, because she was pro-Columbus Day.
Okay.
Ramirez referenced to PayPal's recent attempt to find misinformation, you know, to find misinformation spreaders, you know, alleged misinformation spreaders, $2,500, and then PayPal can, you know, issued a statement saying, oh, no, that was a misunderstanding. We're not doing that. He replied to that comment about PayPal. Why are you celebrating torture, rape, murder, and enslavement? And she said, I teach my daughter real American history. I refuse to join the radical left's campaign to erase history. Then he said, can someone please call child care services on Tina Ramirez, who's teaching her child to be racist? Then he did it.
He called.
He described calling because he was complaining about how long the wait was for Virginia's child abuse hotline and so forth.
Child abuse?
No, it was called Child Protective Services.
Okay.
Tina Ramirez, a single mom who's Latino, and her son, she says, is black. Mighty bold and liberal of you to lecture a Hispanic mother with a black daughter on racism. Mighty bold of him. What are you talking about? It's the lectures on this all come from white leftist honkies wearing pea hats, which I'm sure David Levitt had properly affixed to his head during this exchange. That's journalism in 2022 America. Just picking out a random person on Twitter, Republican candidate for state senate, and calling Child Protective Services on them? Could these people be more vile?
And I bet he has a hate has no home here sign.
I'm sure he does. Good piece, too, over at John Solomon's Just the News, justthenews.com. Seven times just recently, disinformation turned out to be just the opposite, information. And, I mean, I'll just top line it for you, Hunter Biden. But it's just fun because, I mean, this is literally just a couple of years worth, and this is just seven of the most high profile. Hunter Biden's laptop, origins of COVID, COVID-19 vaccines as panacea. Pelosi's Jan 6 role in calling in the National Guard. Since we've got the final day before the midterms of that vaunted J6.
Yes, 1 o'clock Eastern, and all the anchors from the main networks are going to be there.
Reminder that FBI intelligence warned January 6 protesters might storm the Capitol the night before the riot to a top aide to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. That was never sent to frontline police commanders and officers. That FBI intel warning that was sent to Schumer's office the night before. The report came after new revelations showed the Pentagon first raised the possibility of sending National Guard troops to the Capitol 4 days before the Jan 6 riot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Soon, the Capitol Police rejected the offer of troops. Soon after, however, then-Chief Stephen Sund decided he wanted the troops after all, but was turned down by the House Sergeant-at-Arms, who reports to Pelosi. Did you know that? Did you get that coverage from CNN? Right. The mistreatment of Jan 6 defendants. That's sort of a fifth category of misinformation. That's sort of interesting because of all these big blue state governors and big blue city mayors who want to turn people charged with second-degree murder, arson, and kidnapping out back on the streets. But if you trespassed, and that's the charge against you, at the Capitol on January 6th, you're held for hundreds of days without any possibility of bond. Huh. Square that circle. Equal justice before the law. The irregularities in the 2020 election and critical race theory in schools. Just seven categories that just the news goes through of misinformation coming from those great guardians against misinformation. And part of the just generic misinformation is the way they characterize people they agree with versus people they do not agree with on policy matters. I mean, just on a daily basis in every story that has a political tinge. And with the Journalist Corps of today, every story has a political tinge. For more on this, please be joined again by Professor Eric Hoffman. He's professor of politics at Birkbeck College, University of London, author of White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. Professor Kaufman, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Great to be here, Dan.
So you looked at the lingo used by these protectors of proper information, truth, and light, and how they characterize conservatives or people with whom they disagree, even on a just singular issue, versus how they characterize their fellow travelers.
Yeah, well, this is an academic paper that I published with a guy called David Rosato. And all we really did was we looked at 30 million news stories from 54 outlets that were categorized from left to right. And we just took the same prefix, so far left versus far right, radical left, radical right, extreme left, extreme right. So we're comparing exactly the same terms, but with the right and the left switched. And then tracking that in the news media. And what you sort of see is there's a very pronounced skew towards talking about the far right, ultra conservatives, et cetera, and much less coverage of far left, ultra liberals, et cetera. And that's really taken off since about 2015. So we see that really across the board, and especially in left and center outlets. The other thing, by the way, is that the right-wing outlets do mention far left more than far right, but the ratio is a lot more modest. It's kind of like 1.5 mentions of far leftists to far rightists, whereas in the more left-leaning media, such as New York Times or NBC, etc., it's a sort of 4.5 times more mentions of the sort of far right, extreme right, etc., compared to far left and extreme left. So this skew is just that much more pronounced in left-wing press.
Mm. 30 million articles. I mean, is that enough? I mean, are we, you know, I'm waiting for somebody to comment on the sample size, the same people that thought, you know, testing the vax on six mice was sufficient. But anyway,
it was eight mice.
Yeah. But this is not making a value judgment on how they're characterizing something as far left or far right. It's just the actual use of the terminology.
Yeah, that's right. It's a sort of neutral, straight measure because we're using exactly the same terms. And we got a collection of, I think, 13 different terms for left and right. And so I think it's about as close to a sort of neutral test as you're going to find. Now, of course, it could be the case, you know, it could be the case that far right phenomena have increased more than far left phenomena, and that's what accounts for the attention. So we're open to that interpretation. However, I think another interpretation is if you look at the political makeup of the journalism profession, it's really shifted, say, from the 1960s. It was about 1.5 on the left, every one on the right among journalists, and it's now sort of in the region of 5 to 6 on the left versus 1 on the right, and that's all been quite well documented in surveys. So part of what we're arguing is that this shift in the makeup of the journalism profession has inclined it to sort of see right-wing bias much more than left-wing, so focus a lot more on the extreme right than on the extremes of the left. And so I think that's part of what's happening. And the other thing, of course, is this explosion in coverage, use of these terms, extreme right, so on, since 2015 is partly due to the change in journalism from a more classified ads model to more of a clickbait outrage model. And I think that together is what explains this just huge rise in focus on the extremes of the right. I should also add one thing, which is that there's a very high correlation between the use of terms like extreme right and so on with so-called social justice terms such as racism, sexism, inequality, white privilege, and so on. The use of those sort of social justice terms has shot up exactly at the same time as focusing on right-wing extremism. So I think that correlation tells us something about what's driving this.
Well, the press corps has to focus on right-wing extremism because, as the president has said, half the country are semi-fascists.
And it's not to say that there's no increase in coverage of left-wing extremism, but that's just a lot more muted, and it's coming from a much lower base.
Yeah, and it doesn't sell. I mean, look, every publication, they cannot let Trump alone. If he sneezes or if he does something, it's still... Because that's once he got out of office, CNN's ratings dropped immediately.
Yeah, there is a kind of Trump derangement element to this. I mean, the fact that 2015, 16 is when you see this big spike in mentions of right-wing extremism, I think, reflects that moral panic that grips the left around that time. So, yeah, I certainly think that's a catalyst. However, one other interesting wrinkle is that we see the same thing happening in Britain. And although arguably Brexit in the British case is what's possibly behind this.
But go back to the nature of who comprises the press corps, because you've also looked at this. What's the distribution of ideology on a college campus? And with the continued marginalization of dissenting thought on college campuses, with the gatekeepers all largely being of one particular philosophy, and with all of the now the new thing in the 21st century is the layering in of all these die personnel, all these die administrators. Boy, you're incubating all these people to be exactly what they are when they get into a newsroom.
Well, yeah, I mean, you put your finger on a really important development, which is academia has shifted left at the same time as the media has shifted left. So academics also go from about 1.5 left to 1 on the right in the mid-60s to about 6-1 left to right as of the 2010s. So you're seeing the same dynamic, and that's now also there in law schools and medical schools at the elite levels. And it's really changing the game. Yeah, so, I mean, one other paper which David Rosato has written shows that if you look at millions of academic abstracts, so these are the academic papers, and the use of social justice terminology like racism and misogyny and so on, that's quite high starting in the 1980s and 90s, and the media is really not there. And then suddenly, around 2015, the media just converges with what's happening in academia. And that's kind of an illustration of how these trends began in academia, and then suddenly around 2013, 14, 15, 16, they spread off campus into the mass media. And so what happens on campus now really is shaping the wider public. It's not just confined to the campus anymore.
And, you know, Joel Kotkin has wrote a pretty compelling book from my perspective, Joel Kotkin from Chapman University, called The Coming Neo-Feudalism. And essentially, what you're describing is the beginning of the story, that he tells in terms of what may be coming when you have all of these institutions that exercise so much cultural and political and legal power of one philosophy, of one worldview, and acting in a very repressive or an increasingly repressive manner to those with whom they disagree. Boy, you've got a bit of a powder keg that is building in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that that takeover, that sort of capture of not just the universities, but also a lot of the liberal elite institutions, and that's not gone unnoticed. I mean, the trust in university professors, particularly social science and humanities professors, I did a survey, showed that I think only about a third of Republicans trust those professors. They have a higher trust in science professors, in science, engineering, and math. It's about 66, whereas for the social science and humanities, it's 33. And similarly, journalism, trust is right in the toilet amongst Republicans for journalists. I think it's around 20%, something really, really low. So, yeah, that loss of trust in those elite institutions as they become captured by identity politics-based cultural leftism, you know, that, I think, does lead to this kind of polarization, mistrust overall of the system. And that just can't be good for the future of the republic, really.
It speaks probably, at least in the short term, to some election surprises in the offing, I would think.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see. I mean, one thing is that these cultural issues around critical race theory, queer theory, and so on in schools are going, you know, they've already played in the election in Virginia. They've played in Florida. How much they're going to play that along with what's happening at the border, how much that's going to play in the midterms is going to be really interesting to watch. Because in these polls, every sort of 6 months, there's a greater awareness in the public about what's happening on these cultural issues, and they're rising in terms of people's priorities. So, yeah, I think we could see some surprises. Of course, there's many, many moving parts to an election, but, yeah, I think you're right. I think some of that resentment we could see that spilling over in the election results.
He is Eric Kaufman, professor of politics at Birkbeck College, University of London, author of White Shift, Populism, Immigration, and the Future of White Majorities. Professor Kaufman, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we talked about this yesterday, this imbroglio within the L.A. City Council after there was audio taken from 5 years ago and then some more from last year that featured L.A. City Councilwoman Nuri Martinez, who was the chairman of the city council, a couple other Latino city councilmen, and the head of the Federation of Labor in L.A., also Latino, talking about, Nuri Martinez was talking about the son, the adopted son of another councilman. The son is black, the councilman is white and gay, and referred to the kid at an how he behaved at an MLK Day parade like back in 2017 as like a monkey, and he was not behaving properly and so on and so forth, and he needed to be throttled in some way, and then others made disparaging remarks about black members of the council to these others. The president of the Federation of Labor in LA has resigned now. Nuri Martinez yesterday resigned under pressure from the entire Democrat socialist power structure in L.A. and all the way up to the President of the United States, who also called for their resignations. Sort of a remarkable thing how quickly that went.
Mm-hmm.
Or, yeah, but she characterized George Gasson, the non-prosecution prosecutor in L.A., as being with the blacks. She also used derogatory language to describe Jews, Armenians, and indigenous Mexicans from the country's Oaxaca region.
Did she leave anybody out? Because I should know she already made disparaging remarks against LGBTQ. And
bit of a John Rocker screed, it sounds like, for Nuri Martinez over the years.
Wow.
But, you know, I say what I said yesterday about this. Don't be surprised when we all sort of allow the discussion to be categorizing people by racial groups or other identitarian characteristics, and then people talk about them as groups rather than individuals. That's the sickness, is talking about blacks as a monolith, Latinos as a monolith, Armenians, everyone else. But nonetheless, she's gone. And so I'm going to ask the question that we started asking yesterday, too. What about the reckoning for Governor Spaulding here? Now, I know what you're about to hear from his conversations back in the day with Blago under FBI wiretap. I know they were raised. They came out during the 2018 election cycle, and they were raised. But there was no real reckoning because Bruce Rauner was a dead man walking politically at the time. So the press corps covered it. But once Jesse White's arm got twisted into saying, oh, JB's an okay guy, then they dropped it. So what about this? What about the reckoning for this guy? The election in 2018 was about Bruce Rauner's 4 years. The election in 2022 is about J.B. Pritzker's 4 years. And when you listen to this, think about something that we discussed with Beverly Miles, with J.B. Pritzker, which is actually a big discussion point in black-owned media in this city. Cannabis licenses.
Oh, yeah. We're going to offer licenses to women and minorities. And did that happen in the first round? No, it did not.
Social equity was the phrase of the day. It always is. The promise, you're creating a multi-billion dollar industry out of whole cloth through government fiat. That's what you're doing. That's what they did. And there's going to be social equity across all of the racial demographics. And black residents of black business people in Illinois, zero licenses. Zero. So now keep that in mind, because there's a lot of black business people and black leaders. Like I said, you hear these conversations, they're upset about it. They know what was promised and they know what wasn't delivered. Well, maybe he looked at those black applicants for dispensary licenses the way he looked at potential black appointees to the Senate seat vacated by Barack Obama when he was elevated to President of the United States. And here's what he had to say about former Senate President Emil Jones.
I mean, you know, he's just, I don't know how to say it exactly, but Emil's a little more crass.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Among other things, and Emil Jones responded at the time in 2018.
Do you believe he's a racist?
He says so. I didn't.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
He said so. I didn't. That's the other side of his face.
Uh-huh. And on Jesse White, J.B. Pritzker said,
of all the African Americans I can think that are sort of like qualified and people and vetted, and people will say, oh, that's a pretty good pick. The one that is least offensive and maybe gets you the most, because it gets you that Secretary of State appointment, is Jesse White.
Mm-hmm.
The most least offensive black politician is Jesse White.
Those two phrases. Wow. Those two phrases. There's two there. Least offensive is what everybody talks about. What does sort of qualified mean?
Qualified and vetted.
Sort of qualified. The most sort of like qualified
black candidate.
What does that mean?
You
know what I think it means? It means, you know, qualified for a black.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I mean, I'd love to hear from some social justice warrior, hate has no home here, PHAT in the suburbs. You know, one of those white saviors of black and brown folk in the suburbs, about these kind of comments, and tell me how you fly in formation with this kind of person who says these kind of things. While I have no doubt you're cheerleading the resignation of Nuri Martinez and LA City Council, from the LA City Council. Doesn't everybody have to account for what J.B. Pritzker said that was unearthed only 4 years ago? And remember, we're talking about comments from Nuria Martinez that were 5 years old. Doesn't every Democrat have to account? Because I know every Republican would if any Republican used such intemperate language. Not really even a dog whistle. Pretty straightforward. Sort of qualified, least offensive. I mean, you're talking specifically about black candidates. What is he like, least offensive politician, and let's run through a bunch of names. Specifically talking about potential black candidates to appoint to replace Barack Obama to that Senate seat. And, of course, who did Blagojevich ultimately appoint?
Roland Burroughs.
There you go.
Who came on this show to promote a book and gave out his home phone number.
Hey, he's a man of the people. But that's the thing. You know exactly what they were talking about. You know exactly how these conversations go. And you tell me, male impersonator of the left, PUP hats, tell me what that means. Tell me what it would mean to you if I said it. Least offensive, sort of like qualified. There's not been an accounting for that. I don't care if he stands up with some people that for political reasons probably are standing with him, and they did 4 years ago. I want to know now. I want to know after 4 years and what has happened in black neighborhoods. What has happened for black families? What has happened? Well, let's see. The black unemployment rate in the city is 15%. It's 2.5 times what the overall unemployment rate in the city is. Bringing opportunity, the promise on the cannabis licenses. And again, this is setting aside the issue of whether you believe in marijuana legalization, which I don't actually. But if you're going to do it, and if you're going to make a promise, then you keep the promise, regardless of the issue, but including this one. And he didn't.
No, he lied. Strung people along. Then got Kimberly Lightfoot to, you know, try and help out. Oh, here's a black politician that can help you. And still that didn't even work.
Because why? Because where are they going to go? That's the attitude. Because where are they going to go?
We're in charge. They're not.
And where are they going to go?
They're not going to go anywhere. Where are they going to go?
So unemployment rate, I think we've covered in excruciating detail the incidents of violent crime that wildly disproportionately impacts black neighborhoods in Chicago and communities around the state that have significant minority populations, like Rockford, Joliet, East St. Louis. So the schools, K-12 schools, 22% of black third graders in CPS read at grade level. That a success story? Is that J.B. Pritzker delivering for black families? So now go back to those comments and fast forward through the last 4 years of accomplishments in quotation marks. And tell me whether reckoning is due this governor specifically from black families. Oh, Dan, you're howling at the moon and tilting at windmills. This quixotic notion of making an appeal to black voters when you're, a conservative, extremist, blah, 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 racist, homophobe, blah, blah, blah. All the things Charles Thomas says that Democrats call people with whom they disagree, and myself included. Of course, you've heard it. You've heard both the governor and the mayor call me a racist. Okay. All right. Yeah, I am making appeal.
You're homeless.
Because why not? How's it going? How do you, pump your fist at the black city councilman standing up and calling for Nuria Martinez and others to resign, and you sit idly by and watch what J.B. Pritzker did after listening to what he said? Explain it to me. At least like to challenge people to have to process something, to have to defend their behavior, to defend their behavior, particular if it's essentially covering for JB's.
He's in hiding again. No press conferences again today.
John in Libertyville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, this has been a very enlightening topic to be discussing. I talked about it a lot in the 2018 election. One thing you're missing, though, is you're not mentioning that 10 of his own campaign staffers sued his campaign last election for racial discrimination. And there also was one separate suit that was from a transgendered employee who said that they were discriminated against. Yeah. You know, that's how I use the right pronouns, right?
Yeah, right. Thanks for the call, John. Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. There were staffers that resigned after those comments came to light. And, right, I forgot about the discrimination litigation.
Yeah, I
remember that. Uh-huh. So, you know, I said, just explain it to me. Tell me how you would react if it was Darren Bailey saying least offensive and sort of like qualified. Uh-huh. John in Palatine.
Hey, Dan and Amy, how are you? When is somebody going to put a professional commercial together that highlights these in an ad or radio campaign and maybe have someone honorable like Peggy Hubbard bring these issues up and not use a carnival-like clown commercial that helped quash Jeannie Ives' campaign?
I don't know what commercial you're talking about, but okay, thanks for the
call. Yeah, the one that she put on in 2018, and a lot of people didn't like it so much.
Yeah.
That one.
Yeah, well, you're wrong about that commercial, John. You're wrong about that commercial, and you're wrong about it, the impact of that commercial, which is not unusual. But, you know, here again is the reminder to erstwhile center right people who don't say, so like intellectually don't trust the media, but then trust the media's characterization of people with whom they're opposed. Yeah, that's not what happened in 2018 primary at all, John from Palatine. And we have, I have commercials up with Charles Thomas talking about these issues and others to come. So, yeah, I appreciate the political consultancy. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. It goes back to the concept of is what you're describing, the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Yeah.
They think that people aren't, they, you know, their racism is, it's not a get in your face, skinhead, calling you names and stuff like that. It's, you know, just so patronizing and condescending. They won't know any better. The greatest, yeah, as you said, the least offensive. They're all offensive, but this is the least offensive.
Yeah.
And it's you know, if you got to pick one.
Sort of qualified. Qualified by the standards we apply to black people. That's what that means.
And it's completely insulting to anybody who's out there trying to be independent, who has a little bit of more melatonin in their skin. Why would you put up with that? Why would you? And then now Pritzker's hiding from that because he doesn't want to get people of that description upset enough to go out and vote. People got to get out. The team you have is the team you have right now as far as the Republicans. Get out, vote for a Republican, do what you can. It's an opportunity to move the needle to the right.
Thanks, Kevin. Ralph Rantoul.
You know, I got a question, Dan and Amy. When conservatives do things and political figures they don't like, I don't know, I'm thinking of the Trump. They go after his business. Why not, you know, just go after Hyatt and just talk about how, because that's the feed bag that's strapped to that draft horse called Pritzker. He wouldn't have anything without the Hyatt money. And maybe he'd get a little pressure from his family to, you know, hey, you know, you're screwing up the empire. Shut up, JB, and go back to looking at your trust fund statements.
There you go. Thanks for the call, Ralph.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Montgomery Public Schools, Montgomery County Public Schools, Maryland's largest public school district, saw a 582% increase in the number of students identifying as gender nonconforming in the last 2 years. During the 2019-2020 school year, a total of 35 students reported gender nonconformity to a counselor. During the 21-22 school year, it went from 35 to 239, including 18 in elementary school, 129 in middle school, and 92 in high school. 239, almost a 600% increase in 2 years. And what is that attributed to? I mean, I go back to Ross Douthat's column about it can be, you know, these number of factors. It could be comfort level because society is more accepting. It could be more accurate diagnoses of people with gender dysphoria, or it could be a social contagion. I mean, I'm sure there are a variety of factors, but what's the driving force? I think the driving force is the social contagion, and this is just sort of logic at play. You've got an industry that's a $1 billion industry right now, the trans, puberty blockers, mutilation of children, and gender reassignment surgery for adults, that industry. $1 billion industry projected to be a $5 billion industry by
2030, right?
By the end of the decade.
Yeah.
And so you have a lot of interested parties and a lot of promotion of trans and celebration of trans. And so what a society extols, it begets. So this is a society that's extolling this identification. This gives you identity you didn't previously have, gives you profile you didn't previously have in so many circles. You get affirmation from people with credentials. And in many cases, you get the treatment underwritten because these are advocates. Advocates. 600% increase almost in 2 years in Maryland's largest public school district.
Yeah.
In Portland, the Dornbecker Children's Hospital, affiliated with the Oregon Health and Science University, put out a pamphlet, Safe Tucking. Safe Tucking for kids. How to tuck. Try it at home. Choosing a method, tucking with tape, tucking without tape.
Ew, gross.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have one, but that sounds painful.
Notes on the words we use. This information uses the words penis, scrotum, testicles. We know you may not use those terms or identify with them. You don't I have a penis. I don't identify with it.
How does Mayor Lightfoot feel?
Well,
do you think she tucks?
I tell you what, I think that 90% of the men in Hinsdale have a penis and they don't identify with it.
Hey-o.
So I understand what they're saying there at the Dornbecker Children's Hospital. One page of the guide includes diagrams which both describe and depict how men can tuck by putting your testicles inside your body.
Okay.
All right.
I'm getting a tutorial on this. Yeah, I'll leave you guys to this. I'll come back.
No,
when Heather McDonald.
They got pictures.
Oh.
They got a chart. Here's how you do it.
See? What?
So it's here, and then it's there. It's here, and then it's here. You see? Have you had the talk yet? Have you had the talk with your son about tucking? We have another more difficult and serious offering online from somebody who is not too happy with their decision to flip their gender identity, if you will. This is a 21-year-old woman who is taken to posting a video like that other woman you heard from last week. It was really tough to hear, very heartbreaking. 21-year-old woman after 5 years of testosterone. Here's what she says.
Hey, y'all. So I got out of my haircut because my hair was driving me nuts, and I shaved it because I'm tired of watching my hair thin out, and it's less distressing if I shave it. So when I talk about being too far gone, I don't really know what else to call it. This is what I mean. This is how deep my voice is. it's gotten deeper over time, and it's settled. This is what I mean by hair loss.
Receding
hairline.
It
just keeps getting worse. It keeps thinning. It keeps receding backwards. And I'm not exactly sure that's coming back. Those are the main things when I talk about being androgenized to a point of no return. I really don't see those being fixable. So that's when I talk about, just kind of staying how I am, regardless of how I feel. That's why, just because I don't really see me personally being able to come back from what's happened so far. So I hope that's a little explanatory, just to kind of give a little bit more of a, give a more awareness to the situation, kind of so you can see where I'm at. Words are not working well with me right now. I'm just going to cut this off. There you go. This is what happens when you give a woman testosterone this for 5 years. This is what happens, essentially. So, that's it. Stay safe.
16-year-old girl, now 21-year-old woman, 5 years of testosterone. Clearly
losing her hair.
Clearly not ecstatic about it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
And by the way, I mean, this, if you don't think this is everywhere, 4-H. One parent writing, "We've been dismayed by National 4-H's active stance on encouraging youth to take up the LGBTQ agenda, train 4-H volunteers and CRT, and to alter 4-H policies to accommodate creative pronouns, abolish dress codes, and to allow kids to bunk with whatever gender they subjectively identify as." It's called the Thriving Model. And that is apparently incorporated into 4-H programming now. You're losing the farmers. You don't think it's everywhere? And this is the attitude. You heard these poignant, frankly, wails from, they're clearly in distress. The woman you just heard from, the woman you heard from last week who said she's ruined after she had a mastectomy and, she's afraid no one's ever going to love her. I mean, it's tough stuff to hear for kids that were led down this terrible path. The flip side now is what you're dealing with when it comes to the schools, what parents have to stand up against if they've got the stones, if they're not going to be just a, pun intended, they're not just going to be another P-hat poltroon. Here's a non-binary middle schooler bitching about her students and their parents.
I had a fun little conversation with my students yesterday. For those of you who are new, I am very queer. I am non-binary and I use they, them pronouns, and my students know this. But yesterday, I had some boys asking about it and I explained to them, like, here's how you use it, here's an example. We use it in the English language all the time. And they respond with, well, if you're a man, then I can be a woman. And so I looked at him and I said, okay, do you want me to use she, her pronouns for you? And he goes, no. And I responded with, okay, so you're just saying that to hurt my feelings then. And he goes, what? No. Like, yes, you are. You're being a bully. You're being transphobic. And the boys around him kept saying the same stuff. Eventually I shut it down, but how am I supposed to call parents about this behavior when they're probably the people that they learned it from? How am I supposed to ask parents for help when I know that they're not going to respect me?
Mm-hmm. The middle school boys in her classroom are the bullies. The parents are the bullies. Uh-huh.
But who cares if she's non-binary? That's none of our kids' business. I mean, growing up, we had gay teachers, but, excuse me, we never talked about in class because, we wanted to learn English, that we didn't care about his social issues or his narrative or whatever he was pushing. And he didn't push that on us. Those were better times back in the day, I guess.
Yeah, back when men identified with their penises. Margo and Burr Ridge.
Well, first of all, I just have to say, after hearing that woman, why would the parents respect her? She's making everything about her, and it's supposed to be about their kid.
Right.
You know, why are their kids supposed to be interested in her sexual stuff? They're not. Anyway, but I was going to say, I think this really boils down to, at the germ of it all, is that kids, especially teenagers, love attention. They crave attention. And all you have to do is go back to the Salem witches. I mean, they turn themselves into murderesses so that they could get attention because they love the attention so much. And this is how kids are getting attention. And parents, and then, of course, the adults that are aiding and abetting this are, well, I mean, they're just satanic. It's just disgusting, this mutilization of body parts. I hate it. But anyway, attention. That's where it comes from.
Thanks for the call. I don't think there's any other way to explain it than that. The 600% increase in that Maryland County Public School District, largest school district in Maryland. There's no other way to explain it. In the span of two school years.
It's increased that much.
Come on. Can we not pretend we don't know what's going on here? Mark in Plainfield.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And first, my preferred pronouns are Lord or Master.
Yes.
And let me comment that this definitely is a social contagion. 3 years ago, I read in my daughter's diary, she thought she was pansexual. She's going to be 13 in a month, and she's obviously grown out of that. But where does a 10-year-old hear the term pansexual? And you know, the teacher you just played, she is right. It should come from the parents. And I tell my kids routinely, you're either a boy or a girl, or you have something to matter with her. And the good news is I asked my daughter if anyone in her middle school, identifies, and she said no, and I go, good. And I told her, you know what you do if you see a boy identifying as a girl? I said, kick him in the groin and then tell him you look like a boy to me.
All right. Well, I want
violence.
Did you ask your daughter if she has any friends who also have nosy fathers that read her their daughter's diaries? Did you hear that? He read her diary.
Yeah, that's
is that off limits? That seems off limits.
Yeah, that's
to
off
me.
Limits.
Hmm. Yeah.
Dan, you're doing well with your hypothetical children.
Yeah.
Give them personal.
No, I don't. Actually, I don't think it is off limits. But I was just trying to identify with the
his
kids
problem.
Trying to be down with the kids' struggle against mom and dad. Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, I've got a daughter who's trans. She's been that way for 12-15 years now, on hormones, trying to grow, actually succeeding in growing a beard. She's still married. She still has a daughter, but she keeps saying that she's trans, and she keeps saying she's a man. I was talking with my granddaughter some time ago, and I accidentally referred to her as your mother, and that cut her off, so I can no longer see my granddaughter or talk to her. And now she's complaining about all these problems that she's having, these physical problems. And I'm like, hey, look up the symptoms of testosterone poisoning, you know? Come on. No, it can't be that. It can't be that. I'm a man. And there's no argument. It's basically delusional mental health issues, and that's all there is to it. But and as you said, trends, you know? It's like the old days when women would become college lesbians. You know, they went to college. They didn't want to have sex or get involved with that stuff, so they pretend that they were lesbians, and they get out of college and they stop being lesbians. So it's a trend.
Don't look at me.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the
call.
Don't
look at me, Dan.
Good luck with your daughter, Will. Amy, would you like to comment on what Will was saying about the lipstick lesbians in college?
That's
girls
not
of the Big Ten.
Hmm?
What was going on in Iowa City in the 80s?
It was the 90s. Well, late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. See Larry Elder, Brandon Tatum, Alex Berenson, and many more at Freedom Summit Chicago. Tickets available at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It's interesting, the Democrats, what they're attempting to do to address the lawlessness they've unleashed in America's major cities and some mid-major cities, too. A lot of mid-major cities. So they're doing sort of this combination of don't believe your lying eyes, along with, hey, we're still working to reform the system because it's unfair to persons of color. They're still playing the systemically racist game when it comes to law enforcement and prosecutors, while also saying we value and respect law enforcement and prosecutors. This is sort of the conflicting visions that exist in the heads of the left, as evidenced last week when Biden announced that he would be pardoning anyone convicted of federal illegal marijuana charges at the federal level. The claim allows them to bring out their tried and true claim that there are two systems of justice when it comes to the prosecution of crime, one for black Americans and one for white Americans. Well, Heather McDonald took up this assertion in a recent piece at American Mind, AmericanMind.org. Heather McDonald, of course, is the Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor at City Journal, author of The War on Cops and The Diversity Delusion. Now she addresses the marijuana myth in American Mind, AmericanMind.org. Heather McDonald, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Don and Amy. I appreciate it.
So what is the myth that you believe Biden et al. Are perpetuating?
Well, the myth, I don't believe Dodd Biden's perpetuating. He said it outright. It's this hoary meme that the ACLU is largely responsible for that says that blacks and whites use marijuana at equal rates, but the criminal justice system comes down much more harshly on blacks for that equal use. Biden made this announcement in putting forth the marijuana pardons. As you say, Dan, he's gone right back to the default position of Democrats, which is that cops are racist. That is not the message that we need to be sending out now if we want to get crime under control. So what is the truth of his claim? Blacks and whites use marijuana at equal rates, but the system treats blacks much more harshly. It is not true. If you look at treatment admissions data, blacks abuse and are addicted to marijuana at much, much higher rates than whites. One-third of all treatment admissions nationally for marijuana abuse and addiction are for blacks, even though blacks are only about 12 to 13% of the population. D.C., Washington, D.C.'s Department of Health, not exactly a right-wing agency, did a study and found that in Washington, D.C., blacks were 38 times more likely to be admitted to treatment admission for marijuana abuse than whites. And the rate of drug abuse was much, much higher. This is true in every study that I've found. It's also true historically. If you read the great chronicles of 20th century black life, whether by Claude Brown or Richard Wright, you see that marijuana use has just been an integral part of that culture. And the fact of greater drug abuse, and that's true for all drugs, in fact, blacks are admitted for drug abuse and addiction at much higher rates than whites. That's why calls for stricter drug enforcement from the 1950s forward have always come from black communities. Black newspapers, black leaders, they have said with regards to crack cocaine, This is the worst oppression that has hit our community since slavery. The war on drugs is not a war to re-enslave blacks. That's the left-wing myth perpetrated by Michelle Alexander, and it's a complete lie.
And it was repeated recently by our very own Cook County State Attorney Kim Fox. Here, the thing is, I'm glad you point that up, because Michael Javon Fortner, who used to be at, I think, CCNY, but he looked back at this. He wrote a book about it, and the war on drugs that was initiated in New York under Nelson Rockefeller was pushed not by Nelson Rockefeller. It was pushed by black families in neighborhoods pushing Nelson Rockefeller and the state leaders in New York State to do something about the scourge of drugs in their neighborhoods.
Dan, you're absolutely right. Fortner has documented this. Before him, Randall Kennedy wrote about the Black Caucus, Congressional Black Caucus, pushing for much stricter penalties for crack cocaine. James Forman at Yale Law School has also documented that. In Forman's case, against his inclinations, because he's no conservative, but he had to admit that this was not, as Michelle Alexander in the New Jim Crow put it, disastrously. I mean, this Michelle Alexander's book is so influential on college campuses. She's the one that claimed that the war on drugs was an effort to re-enslave blacks and the new Jim Crow, to resegregate them in prisons. It's not the case, the war on drugs has been something that blacks have pushed for. But the irony, Dan and Amy, is that the truth about drug possession and use is actually irrelevant to the question of convictions for marijuana possession, because nobody is convicted in the federal system or the state system for merely having smoked a joint. Virtually all marijuana possession convictions, especially at the federal level, which is where Biden acted, are pled down for more serious crimes, whether drug trafficking or violence. Possession is much easier to prove than trafficking. In 2013, 90% of drug possession convictions at the federal level originated at the border. The average weight possessed by these alleged recreational pot smokers was 48 pounds of marijuana. Now, that's one very big blunt, but somebody who's possessing 48 pounds is not a recreational pot smoker. Those were all traffickers,
right?
And they pled to possession because that was a much easier way to get them. So the fact of black drug abuse is actually irrelevant to this question. The reason Biden trotted out the usual meme is simply because the Democratic Party is in thrall to the idea that America is systemically racist and they cannot help themselves. This is not the moment to be putting this out there. Americans, voters, are rightly terrified about the ongoing post-George Floyd crime increase. This would be the time, if ever, as you said, to try to rebrand the party, however hypocritically and fallaciously, as a party of law and order, and yet they cannot restrain themselves from putting out this same poisonous rhetoric about racist cops.
Well, I have a question for you. So do you think they made marijuana legal to gain revenue from it, or to keep African Americans out of jail?
I think, well, probably both. I don't think they're inconsistent. It's always pleasant when you can parade your virtue and make money. Of course, that hasn't really worked out, because all in California, it simply increased the illegal market. You know, all these legal dealers, where we've got now all of these preferences for black marijuana dealers because they're paying taxes or supposed to pay taxes, and so the illegal market is still thriving. But I think that it is impossible to overstate how strongly the idea that there is this thing called mass incarceration, which is prejudiced against blacks, is central to Democratic thinking. The mass incarceration idea is also a myth. Incarceration in this country is driven by our astronomical levels of violent crime, unlike anything in the rest of the Western world. You know, the left loves to compare our incarceration rates to Germany and Japan. Are you kidding me? I think in all of Japan, there's maybe 5 people killed by homicide a year compared to the over 20,000 we have. I mean, our homicide rates, our gun homicide rates are off the charts. And our prison rate has nothing to do, again, with the war on drugs. That's the other claim, that it's the war on drugs that is responsible for blacks being disproportionately in prison. No, I did a calculation that nobody else had done, which is to remove all drug prisoners from the state system of prisons, which is where 88% of the population in prisons resides. If you take out all drug offenders, the black rate of incarceration, which is about a third of all prisoners, doesn't budge. So drug offenses have no effect on black incarceration rates. Blacks are incarcerated at higher rates than whites. That's undeniably true. But the reason is because they commit homicide and shootings and robberies at such higher rates. This last year, the rate at which young black males between the ages of 10 and 24 are killed by gun homicide reached 25 times higher than white males of the same age. 25 times. Why? They're not being killed by the police. They're not being killed by whites. They're being killed by other blacks. The black gun homicide rate is equally disproportionate. And that's true in Chicago. You know, blacks are commit about 80% of all homicides and shootings, even though they're a little under a third of the population, same ratio as whites. Whites commit about 1 to 2% of all shootings and homicides in Chicago. So those disparities are real, and when you demoralize and delegitimize the police, which is what Biden ran on as a presidential candidate, it was his speech upon taking office. He brought up the white supremacy argument again. It's been his theme ever since then. When you demoralize the cops, they back off. They leave the department. Chicago is way down in cops because nobody wants to be in a profession where from the day one you start that job, you're deemed by the elite establishment as a racist.
She is Heather McDonald, Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, contributing editor of City Journal, author of The War on Cops, as well as The Diversity Delusion. Heather, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.